All right, so this is Bio 231, and it is August 22nd. This is our third lecture, and we're going to finish up cells today, which is chapter 2, and then move on to tissues next time. So I'm recording, and then probably this week sometime I'll get these three lectures online for you to download. But last semester's and the semester before recordings are still online if you want to listen to those. Last time we talked about organelles inside the cell. What's your favorite organelle that we talked about last time? Mitochondria, because it makes ATP, right? So just think of that list of organelles. We have rough endoplasmic reticulum, smooth ER, Golgi, secretory vesicles, lysosomes. So make sure you know what they look like on an exam figure. A good exam figure, for instance, would be this one right here. Okay, so make sure you know that this looks like a Golgi apparatus. Here's the nucleus and nucleolus, but also know what the function is for these different organelles. So on a test, for instance, I might have this exact figure, of course, with all the labels erased, and I might have number 56 right here instead of the label ribosome, and then you're going to have a list of terms, a word bank, and they have like an A, B, C, D, or A, B, C, or C, D, E in front of them. And then to answer this question here, you would just bubble in on your Scantron the proper three-letter, four-letter, or five-letter designation for ribosome on that one line number to get that question correct. So know the shape of these different structures as well as what their function is. And whenever you change the shape of something, like from this Golgi apparatus to this mitochondria, what would you expect? If you change the shape of something, you change the function of them, right? So if you change the anatomy of something, you change the physiology of what that structure can do. So that's important to know. All right, so we talked about all these different organelles last time, so you should know some bullet point information about each of these structures right here. Okay, like for instance, mitochondria, you said, makes ATP. What about rough endoplasmic reticulum? What does it do? It makes proteins. What about smooth ER? It makes lipids or fats, right? Golgi apparatus is for modifying and packaging. What about cilia and flagella? It is, in one word, motility. So if you have those bullet points in your mind, I think you'll be doing really good on the test. Maybe you won't see those exact bullet points, but you can figure out what the question is, right? Okay, now what we didn't talk about yet so far is movement across membranes, and we didn't talk about protein synthesis. In lab, we talked about cell division. So those are the three things that we need to talk about in today's lecture, unless you have a question and want to go back and review some of the information that we talked about on Wednesday. Okay, movement across the plasma membrane, and you got a really nice fancy picture of what a plasma membrane looks like. Remember, its basic structure, what's a basic structure? Is it one layer or two layers? Two layers, so here's the first layer right here, here's the second one down below it. They're kind of a mirror image of each other. It's called a phospholipid bilayer. So here's the little phosphate group, and then the lipid part is toward the inside of the membrane. And because there's a lipid part right here, that means that there's a certain kind of molecule that can't move across the membrane. And you're probably aware of that, what that is already, just haven't maybe necessarily thought about it. But for instance, if you were making a bagel this morning or English muffin or toast and put some butter on it, and you got some butter on your clothes, how could you clean up that mess before you came to school? Could you use just water?
No.
Absolutely not, right? So lipid molecules are a different environment completely compared to water-soluble molecules. They just do not like to mix. So if this is a lipid part of the membrane, that means that anything, water or anything that can dissolve in water can't get through the membrane because this lipid internal part keeps it out. All right, so you can think of this as like a little butter layer right here that's keeping water on the outside of the cell and water on the inside of the cell. They can't move across. Nonetheless, there are some other components of the membrane, like this channel right here, that can allow water to move across the membrane or other kinds of water-soluble compounds. Like, what did you put in your coffee this morning? Or tea, that is water-soluble. That can't cross the membrane right here, but since there's a pore, it can under certain circumstances. For instance, like sugar. Yeah, sugar dissolves in coffee. I don't think anybody put salt. Maybe somebody did. You never know. Salt dissolves in water. Can't get through the membrane, right? But under certain circumstances, a special little protein will allow salt to move back and forth. So let's talk about the circumstances that allow for transport of molecules from one place to another, and maybe even specifically across this membrane if there's a pathway for it to move from one place to another. Okay. So when we think of transport processes, there are two main transport processes that you should be aware of. There's passive transport and active transport. Right? Passive transport means that it's something that happens automatically. It doesn't require an energy source. An active transport process, on the other hand, right? When we say active, it means it requires energy for it to happen. And in your body, what is the energy source? What's the organelle that's giving you that energy source? It is ATP, and the organelle is mitochondria, right? So ATP comes from a mitochondria. It allows active transport to happen. So let's just maybe kind of diagram some of these things. Let's just say that you're out camping someplace, right? So here you are, and then there's your little tent in the background, and you're thirsty all of a sudden, okay? And there's some water down here in the ground. Water down here in the ground, and you need to drink that water. What do you need to do to get at this water right here? If you put a hole, I guess I'm going to have to give up on the, I'm in the boundary zone up against the blackboard, the way the microphone is pointing. We can put a little tube into the ground and insert it into this water that's underground. I turned it down too much, didn't I? Can you still hear me in the back? Good enough? So if you put this little tube in the ground, okay, is that water automatically going to come up so that you can take a drink? You know what? In most cases, it won't. What do you need? You need to put another little device right here with a big handle on it so that you can walk over to this thing and move this handle up and down. What do we call this thing? A pump, and that can pump water from underground to bring it up on the top so that you can drink it. But what does this handle need to move up and down? It needs energy to do that, right? And you're supplying that energy. And as a matter of fact, the energy you're using is ATP to get that water. So water can go from low to high right here, right? If you what? It can move in this direction as long as you can put in energy. And we call that what kind of process? Is that active or passive? That's active, right? Now, say you've had enough to drink and you don't want to be wasteful, you want to put that water back. All you got to do is put the water back over this hole, and what will happen to it? It will go back down over here. All right, so if something goes from high to low, will that happen automatically, or do you need to spend energy to get it back down there? No, water will just flow downhill, right? So this condition over here is active when something goes from what? Low to high. And it is passive when things go from high to low. But there's another way I want you to think about this, not just in terms of levels underground, but also in terms of concentration of molecules. Right? Concentration. So if something has a high concentration, you have a lot of particles. Right, a lot of particles of whatever that substance is. It could be water or whatever. It could be salt. And then over here, low concentration means particles that are really far apart. So here is a high concentration. Here is what? A low concentration. And this just means that if we have a gas or a mixture of fluid, particles will move from high concentration to low concentration in which way? Active or passive? A passive process, right? Molecules can move from low concentration to high, but not all by themselves. What do they need? They need energy for that to happen. So, for instance, consider this. Say I have a perfume bottle in my hand, and it's really a high concentration of perfume. When you look at it, it's all just perfume inside there, nothing else, just perfume. I open the bottle up. It dissolves into the air, okay? And now you have a little bit of concentration of perfume in the air, but what's the concentration of perfume in the back of the room? Yeah, low to zero. Let's just say zero. All right, so that perfume molecule, even though there's no fan blowing the air around, that perfume molecule is going to move from the bottle to where? To the back of the room. Who's going to smell it first? It just doesn't magically appear in the back. First row, then second row, then third row. Okay, and then finally all the way in the back of the room, so that perfume moves from high concentration to low concentration by what we call a passive process that we have right here. We call that diffusion. Okay, and if we leave that perfume bottle open all night long and then walk in the room and we can smell the perfume with a certain smell here in the front and we walk to the back, it's going to have the same intensity. Right, if we wait long enough, perfume is just going to uniformly fill the room. And when it uniformly fills the room, then no more diffusion is going to take place. Because what you need is a gradient in concentration to move things around via a passive process. And what's this first passive process that we're talking about? Diffusion. And that can happen to molecules that are in a gas or liquid, but it can't happen in a solid. Like this tabletop right here. Nothing can really diffuse through a solid compound, like that cement pillar or this wood tabletop. It needs to be a gas or a liquid for that to happen. Okay. All right, so here we have things moving from high concentration to low down over here. If we wait long enough, same number of dots in both places. But we can have a special circumstance where we put a cell membrane right here, right? And don't forget, it's a phospholipid bilayer. What kinds of things can move across this membrane right here? Only things that can dissolve in lipid. So if we have a water molecule, that can't dissolve in. But let's just say we put a nice pore like this right there. So H2O is water. Okay. And which way is and all these little dots represent water right now. It can get through this little pore. Which way is water going to move? It's going to move, let's just say this is intracellular. And if this is inside the cell, this is outside, so this is what we call extracellular space right here. So water will move from extracellular to intracellular through this little pore, like this. And is it going down its concentration gradient or up its concentration gradient? High to low is going down, just like think of this little example right here. So it's going down a concentration gradient. Does it require energy? No, so it's passive. So this is diffusion. But since we have a cell membrane right here, we'd like to give it a special term because this membrane is special. So water can get through, but for instance, we can have another really big molecule like magnesium, and it has some electrical charges on it. So magnesium is just a salt. Does salt dissolve in water? If you take table salt, for instance, which is sodium and chloride, which is kind of like this magnesium right here, does it dissolve in water? Yes, but not lipid. So magnesium can't get through the membrane right here, because remember, what's the inside of this membrane? It's fat. It's lipid. Sorry. It's lipid. I can't think about what I'm saying, what I want to say, and what I did say, and think about spelling at the same time. But anyway, I try. Lipid, so here's lipid, so magnesium can't get through. All right, so with this so here's a membrane, right? Membrane. Okay, so water can diffuse across a membrane, but there are other things that can't. Magnesium tries, but it gets bonked out. Right? Tries again, what happens? Can't get through. So what do we how do we classify this membrane right here? It can allow some things across, like water, but what about other things? No. So this is what we call semi-permeable or selectively permeable. A special kind of membrane. Semi-permeable. So if it's permeable, that means something can go through it. If it's not permeable, something can't get through it. All right, so these are three things. Water can go through the membrane, number one. But how does it go through, actively or passively? Passively. Number two, there's got to be a membrane. And number three, it's got to be semi-permeable. And if all those criteria are met, guess what we have? We have osmosis. That's going to be a real important property, especially when you get into a physiology class. All right, so just remember, osmosis is what kind of transport, active or passive? It's special, but nonetheless, it's still passive. Does not require energy. Remember, water can go from high concentration to low through this little pore, but this right here is a special kind of membrane. It doesn't allow everything to go through it. So if you have water moving across the membrane passively, and that membrane only allows certain things to go through, then it is osmosis. Okay, so those are two passive processes. So is osmosis diffusion? Is osmosis diffusion? Aha! You're going to say, oh, you know what? It is. There it is in the definition. Osmosis is just a special kind of diffusion. Okay, so I tried to be a little bit tricky there. Just to get those terms rectified in your mind. It is. Osmosis is diffusion. Well, what do you need? You need a membrane, and it's got to be not just any old kind of membrane. It's got to be semi-permeable or selectively permeable. All right, in terms of the other kind of process, active transport requires energy, and one kind of energy is ATP. And ATP can be broken down. I don't have a picture of ATP, so I'll draw it on the board. Really, really fast. The way I draw it, it's not too complicated. Okay, so here is a part of a molecule called adenosine. That's one part of it. And then here is a phosphate, which I'm going to abbreviate with a P, sticking off adenosine. And adenosine triphosphate has how many of these P's on it? What does tri mean? Yeah, three. Thank goodness, sometimes school is really simple. So here is ATP. And these are chemical bonds between these phosphates. There's a lot of energy in this bond right here. And if it's ATP, that energy is trapped in this bond. How can you get at this energy in this chemical bond? Oh, thank goodness, here's a little Coke. Let's see if somebody shook it up while I wasn't looking. No, you guys are lucky. All right, how your body gets at that energy is that it chops off this phosphate right here, and you get something that looks like this. Okay, and then that energy goes away someplace, and then you're left with this molecule over here, which I'm going to abbreviate PI. That stands for inorganic phosphate. All right, so what is this molecule? If this is ATP, what's this molecule down here? ADP, adenosine diphosphate. Adenosine diphosphate comes from ATP, and when it does, it releases this energy for doing what? It could be for maybe pumping water one way or the other, or pumping chemical compounds that can't get through this membrane, like magnesium or sodium or chloride, things like that. So, oh, here it is, right here. Okay, so active transport requires ATP. It's converted to ADP, inorganic phosphate, and energy for transport or moving things around inside the cell. Now, your cell is happy, but now what does a mitochondria do with this ADP and inorganic phosphate? What's the job of mitochondria? Think about that for a second while I have a drink. The job of mitochondria is to take ADP, inorganic phosphate, and make ATP out of it again. Right? Because you told me just a couple minutes ago that the job of mitochondria is to what? Make ATP. All right. But what else does mitochondria need in order to make ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate? Look what we got right here. It needs energy. All right. So what do we use for energy? Well, what some people use would be like the sugar in Pepsi Cola or Coca Cola, right? So we have to have nutrients in our diet to feed mitochondria, to fuel them so that mitochondria can make ATP from ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right, so the different kinds of processes, molecular transport across a membrane, and we had some of that, right, through Where's that slide? Is this it right here? Oh, yeah. It's maybe opening or closing this little gate right here requires ATP, causes a conformation change. Can open and close this little channel, and then it becomes a gate. That's for just the passage of molecules across the membrane. Something else that can happen, okay, is this an example? Oh, yeah. Here's a pretty good example. All right, so here are some lipid-soluble molecules can go across the phospholipid bilayer because it can diffuse through the lipid. Here are some water molecules, right? Water-soluble molecules can't get through, like sugars and salts and things like that. In this particular case, this channel is open all the time, but in this particular case, it's not open all the time. You can see that it's closed on one end. It's open to the outside world. So here is a process where a molecule, let's work in the opposite direction. This molecule can move into this protein inside the membrane, and then ATP will be hydrolyzed to cause a conformation of this protein, kind of like a teeter-totter. So on the slide, it's open to the outside of the cell. With ATP, it can change conformation to where the opening is where now, to the inside of the cell, and what was ever in that cavity inside this protein can now go from the outside to the inside of the cell. Okay, so that is a macromolecular transport mechanism. Like what I have right here. Macromolecular transport. If it goes from the outside to the inside, we call that phagocytosis. Cytosis is just a cellular process. Phago is what? Eating. The phagocytize something is eating. So phagocytosis literally means cell eating. So taking things inside the cell is phagocytosis. All right. If it's something that's on the inside that moves to the outside of the cell, that's called exocytosis. Do I have that on there? Indeed. That's going the opposite direction. But what molecule is need besides the one that's being transported? It needs, is it passive or active? That's a clue. Okay. It's an active process. It requires ATP as well, as you see on this diagram right here. So leaving the cell is exocytosis. The corresponding term to exocytosis is endocytosis, entering the cell. There are two endocytotic processes. One, if it's a solid particle, we call it phagocytosis. If it's just fluid that's entering the cell via this mechanism, it's called pinocytosis. So pinocytosis is cell drinking, phagocytosis is cell eating. Both of these, you might want to put a little bracket right here, both phagocytosis and pinocytosis are what? Kinds of endocytosis, E-N-D-O, endocytosis. Going the other way is exocytosis. And in each case, what else is needed? Energy in the form of ATP, okay? Not in the form of glucose or other kinds of tasty food molecules that we eat. It's got to be ATP. And where does the cell get ATP from? Mitochondria. Okay, now how important is that? Let's just spend a second or two with ATP to find out how important it is and how much you need. Okay, a typical body weight of somebody, all right, in a textbook is 70 kilograms. And I forget how much 70 kilograms is. I mean, it's 130 pounds, something like that. Not very much, okay, but that's just a textbook figure. The 70 kilogram man is about a 70 kilogram kind of beast running around. And so how much weight in ATP do you need every day to stay alive? As just a proportion of your body weight. And it's pretty amazing. Yeah, it's 40 kilograms, which is more than half your body weight, is used up, right, converted into ATP, releasing energy to keep you alive. Of course, you don't need to have 70 kilograms at any one moment, because as soon as you break an ATP down into ADP, what happens to it? It gets made back into ATP via what? Mitochondria, yeah, inside all the organs of your body. As long as mitochondria have oxygen. If mitochondria don't have oxygen, which is the reason why we do what? inhale to get that oxygen in us, right? So those mitochondria stay happy and make a lot of ATP. If we stop delivering oxygen to the brain, then all those mitochondria in our brains can't make ATP. The first thing will happen is that you'll lose consciousness. Because to maintain consciousness, you need ATP to run all these pumps right here. Right? How long do you have? What's the period of time of consciousness you have when blood is cut off to the brain? Okay, maybe we covered this last week. Yeah, it's about 3 seconds, 4 seconds, so it's just a matter of seconds and you lose consciousness. Now, your brain isn't dead just yet. Okay, it can still be revived. It can still come back to life consciousness as long as somebody restores that blood flow to your brain, which is why, is anybody in here CPR certified? Fantastic. Come on down to the front row, please. Next lecture, okay? And if somebody knows CPR, they can actually do chest compressions that beat somebody's heart for them when their heart isn't beating by themselves. That forces some blood to the brain, keeps their brain alive. But if your heart stops, okay, and you don't have anybody there that's CPR certified that can do chest compressions properly, how long do you have before your brain actually dies? It runs out of so much ATP, can't maintain life processes, and it dies. And when it dies, what does that mean? Can't come back to life, right? No matter what you do. We're learning how to extend that more and more. But typically, how long do you have before your brain dies? Yeah, just a number of minutes. So you might want to say 3 to 4 seconds when you lose consciousness, 3 to 4 minutes, and the brain actually dies. Right, so not very long. That kind of underscores how important what molecule is for maintaining life in your body. It is what molecule? ATP. Okay. All right, well, that's not the only important molecule. That's one. You have some others that are important. Another kind of molecule that is important, not necessarily just for energy metabolism, but for structure as well inside the body. Oh, look what I found. The sign-in sheet. Okay, if you don't sign the sign-in sheet, even though you're here, what are you? You're absent, right? So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. So find your name on there. If your name's not on there, that is the registration roll from before I added students. So just sign at the very bottom. And it's by alphabetical order, and so sign it really fast and pass it on so everybody has a chance of signing in. Because otherwise, they're what? They're absent, even though they're here, right? So don't jip anybody out of being here because they're here, but they didn't sign in, so they're not here. Okay, protein synthesis. There are just a few important biological molecules in your body. Okay, one important thing are called sugars. All right, sugars, another name for sugars you probably know is what? Carbohydrates, right? They have some basic building blocks. All right, second kind are proteins. And that's what we're going to look at right now. And does anybody know what the building block of proteins are? Amino acids. All right, are pretty important. So understanding building blocks is an important function for you to appreciate in this class. We looked at that the very first lecture. What's the building block of life? A cell, that's right. If something's not made of cells, then it can't be alive. Well, what's the building block of a tissue? A tissue is made up of what? Cells, okay. And then you have an organ. What's the building block of an organ? Tissues, right? So if you put more than one tissue together, you get an organ. Right, to get a tissue, you got to have more than one cell, but they all have to have the same kind of touch and feel to them. They got to look the same, function the same. Then they'll be a tissue. Now, protein, the building block is amino acid. And then, just for your information, a couple other kinds of tissues, sugars, proteins. Oh, we talked about one over here. You got what? Lipids. And you can see mixed membranes, important energy source as well in your body. And then nucleic acids. What are nucleic acids good for? Making, yeah, DNA. Okay, RNA. That DNA makes up chromosomes, a part of an important chromosome. But what we're going to talk about right now is this subgroup right here, namely proteins. So your body has to make proteins, and you know that it makes proteins from building blocks called amino acids. It puts amino acids together. All right, so you have about 20 different kinds of amino acids in your body. So your cells have to know what amino acids belong next to each other to spell out a word. So you can think of amino acids as being the letters that are used to spell out a word. Like to spell out amino, what do you need? What's the first letter? A, you know, and then M. So these could be different amino acids in a protein. In order for you to make a particular protein that your body needs, it has to spell it out properly. Like this might be tyrosine and then tryptophan, cytosine, arginine. You don't have to know the names of all those, but those are different amino acids. And if it gets spelled out properly, then the body, your body has built a proper protein. And of course, since, you know, your body should make the proteins that it needs and not other proteins that it doesn't need. Okay, so how does it know how to spell out different kinds of proteins? All right, so this is what I have right here on the slide for you. All right, and we call this the central dogma in biology. This is a pretty good place to start to know something about protein synthesis. And what I have right here is a flow diagram of information. So it's not physical structures necessarily that flow one way or the other. So it's not electrons, it's not protons, it's not elements. It's really information. And information is stored in your DNA. Right? Where do you find DNA? What organelle? Your nucleus, right? And DNA makes chromosomes. That's the library. That's where all the information is contained to build your particular body, right? A cells, and then also how cells function. So information in DNA, which is found in the nucleus, travels into RNA. That's another kind of nucleic acid. And then that RNA, the information in RNA is used to make a protein. So how many step process is protein synthesis? Okay. Let's take a look. The hint is, how many arrows do you see? Ah, I see two arrows. So let's look at that one more time. How many steps does it take to make a protein? One or two? Two, because you see two arrows. You're going to have to know the names of these arrows in just a second. But you should also know where these different processes take place. This first step of converting information in DNA into RNA, this first step right here happens inside the nucleus of the cell. Right? That's inside the nucleus. And then RNA is inside the nucleus and it moves out through those nuclear pores. It moves into the cytoplasm where a protein is made. So where do we find, where does this second step take place? This first step takes place in the nucleus because that's the only place that we find DNA. Where does the second step take place? In the cytoplasm. Yeah, so draw that maybe on this diagram. I didn't draw it on here because I didn't want it to get too complicated. Now take a further look at these arrows. Is it a one-way arrow or a bidirectional arrow?
One-way.
Okay, so information can't go back. So proteins that you have in the body can't go back and actually make chromosomes. They can't go back. And so this is what we call the central dogma. Dogma is something that you should never challenge, you should always believe, right, for the rest of your life. All right, now what can you tell me about dogma and science? Two totally different things, right? So dogma is something you shouldn't challenge. And what about science? Always challenge, always question, always learn, always evolve, right? So this is a good place for you to start, but you might have to change this sometime in your life, but this is a good place to start. And for a long time, people believe this is true. And that's really handy, okay, because, for instance, if you were to have a bunch of protein in your diet tonight, like what would you eat? Maybe a chicken dinner, right? Maybe you have some drumsticks or something. You don't have to worry about waking up in the morning and having that information of how to build a chicken muscle incorporated into your DNA or chicken feathers. You never have to worry about waking up with feathers and a beak in the morning. Right, because your food can't change what these chromosomes are like. Because what is this street right here? Is it two-way or one-way? Just a one-way street, right? Information always flows from DNA to RNA to protein, not the reverse. All right, so you should know where these processes take place. The first process happens where?
nucleus, the second process happens in the cytoplasm. All right, so we said the building block of a protein are what? Amino acids. Does anybody know what the building block of a nucleic acid is? Probably not, because that's why you're in school, right? You're learning some of these things. It's going to be a nucleotide. Nucleotide. So I'm just going to leave this on the board. Nucleotides are the building blocks for nucleic acids. There's about 20 important amino acids in your body. You only have about 4 or 5 important nucleic acids, much fewer. Okay, but that's the building block. Okay, so here are the two processes. So this first arrow right here that happens in the nucleus is what we call transcription. And the second arrow right here is what we call translation. And it might really help you to look up those two terms in the dictionary to know what they mean in everyday language. And they're not really complicated. And that will help you understand this two-step process. All right, so transcription is the conversion of information in DNA into RNA. All right, and this occurs in the nucleus because why? That's the only place where we find DNA is inside the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. And what does transcription really mean in everyday language? You use it all the time. Maybe you're not relating it to this class right away, but for instance, maybe you're going to go out tomorrow and apply for a job, and they maybe require that you've taken some classes, college-level classes, and how would you prove them that you've actually taken some college-level classes and passed them? You'd give them a transcript. And what's a transcript? It's a photocopy of your record that's in administration and records. So transcription is an exact duplicate of what you already have. All right. So transcription is taking information in DNA and converting it into RNA. And the reason why it's an exact duplicate because, right, of what the building block of RNA is. What's the building block of, nucleic acids? Two kinds of nucleic acids. We have DNA, number one, and number two, RNA. Both the same building block, which is a nucleic acid. All right, so what can you tell me about the language? All right, what is the language that's used to spell out DNA and to spell out RNA? It's a nucleotide. Right? It's the same language. It's just that RNA is a copy of DNA using the same language. It's like a photocopy. RNA is like a photocopy of DNA. Where is that photocopy taken? What part of the cell? It's in the nucleus. And that's because this DNA information is so important, can't ever be damaged. It's got to be protected by the nuclear membrane. That protects it from all kinds of junk that's happening inside the cytoplasm that might break it down. Okay, there are a couple of different kinds of RNA that are made. There is the ribosomal RNA, usually spelled out with a little r and then capital RNA. That's the workbench where a protein is going to be made. And ribosomes, you've seen before. Where have you seen them before? Yeah, they participate because they join endoplasmic reticulum and make it rough ER, okay, or they're freely floating in the cytoplasm, okay? And what did we say? What's the bullet point function of ribosome? Protein synthesis. What are we talking about right here? Protein synthesis, right? So transcription makes the pieces for the ribosome, namely ribosomal RNA. Okay, that's the workbench where a protein is going to be made. So where is where do we find proteins? In the nucleus or in the cytoplasm? Cytoplasm, so that's where we find ribosomes. All right, so the ribosome needs building blocks to make a protein. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids. So there's something that has to bring amino acids to a ribosome for that ribosome to make a protein, and that's called transfer RNA. That's the second kind of RNA that is made in the nucleus. Transfer RNA, abbreviated tRNA, carries amino acids to the ribosome. Okay, sometimes you could even call that T for taxi. Taxi RNA brings ribosomes over to make a protein. All right, the third kind of RNA is called messenger RNA, and that contains the sequence right? Or the proper spelling on how to make a particular protein. So that's why we call it the messenger RNA. Okay, so where are all of these different RNAs made? Messenger, transfer, and ribosomal RNA. This is what I want you to know. Where are they made? In the nucleus, okay, never in the cytoplasm. And what is the name of the process that makes messenger, transfer, and ribosomal RNA? Transcription, and what is used to make it? What's the template? What's the precursor molecule? It is DNA, right? So information is converted from DNA to RNA, happens in the nucleus. And why do we call that transcription? I want you to think in terms of building blocks. What are the building blocks of DNA and RNA? Are they the same or different? They're the same, they're nucleotides, right? So that's why it's called transcription. So RNA is like a photocopy, or it's a transcript. Okay, then that RNA leaves the cell. The second step is translation, and that converts RNA into proteins. All right, so what can you tell me about translation? There are probably a lot of people in here that can translate. All right, what does that mean? But you have to tell me in English. You don't have to, but let's start with English. That's kind of a hint. That's actually sort of a little joke, kind of a pun, right? What does translation mean? It means that you're converting information from one language to another. Maybe you're talking in Hindi and you need to talk to somebody that speaks only Farsi. What do you need? Well, you need a translator that understands both languages. Okay, now what about the information content between Hindi and Farsi? It's going to sound different, right? But what about the information content if the translator that you're paying is doing a good job? What about the information? Exactly the same. The words are going to be spelled completely different. The script, the writing, the sound is going to be completely different. But what about the information? Okay? Help, I need a glass of water, right? Help, I need a glass of water in one language. Help, I need a glass of water in the other language. Two totally different sounding things. That's what translation is. All right, so we say that the second step is translation because what's the building block of RNA? What's the language of RNA? Nucleotide language, what's the language of a protein? Amino acids, they're two different languages. So you need some kind of program that converts one to the other, and that's what we find in the cytoplasm. We call that translation. Might have to take a biology class or physiology to know a little bit more detail about how that happens, but at least you should know this scheme right here and how to fill in the pieces. Like know the building blocks, know what these two arrows are, one-way arrow or two-way arrow, okay? And then what would you call arrow number one right here? That's transcription. And then arrow number two, translation. And if you got transcription followed by translation, what do you end up with? A protein inside your body, okay? All right, so that's the level that I want you to know protein synthesis at in here. Okay, cell division. I think this is our last topic in this particular chapter. Cell division is a kind of reproduction, and in lab we talked about what kind of reproduction it is. What kind of reproduction is it? It is, I heard the right answer someplace, it is asexual. All right, so just think of sexual reproduction. What does sexual reproduction produce? Look around the room and compare what you see to you. What do you see? You see another you in here? No. Sexual reproduction produces different things all the time. And is that diversity good or bad? Diversity good or bad? Okay, yeah, okay. We'll talk about that sooner or later. It's really, really good. All right, but asexual reproduction produces what? The same thing over and over and over again. You could think of that as being like clones. So for mitosis, where you start with a parent cell, and that parent cell divides into two daughter cells, these daughter cells are exactly the same, and the daughter cells are exactly the same as the parent cell. So if the daughter cells are the same as the parent cell, is that sexual or asexual reproduction? It is asexual reproduction. Mitosis just produces the same thing over and over and over again. So here are some diagrams some really fancy illustrations I'll reproduce on the board that I drew in lab. So mitosis, you start with a single cell. What do we call this single cell? That's the parent cell. How many chromosomes, let's just say humans, are in this parent cell right here? The 46. And then it goes through this multi-step process, right, to produce these two cells right here with the nucleus. How many chromosomes in here? 46. Exact same number. Okay. What about the color of these cells? Are they different or the same? They're all the same, right? So there's no difference in these cells right here. These are the daughter cells. Here's the parent cell. Right here. Okay. Well, if you have 46 chromosomes here and 46 chromosomes in the two daughter cells, but you only start with 46, how is it when you split the cell up and you start with 46, you still get 46 in both daughter cells? What has to happen to these? Yeah, they have to be replicated. Okay. So here is what just a nice simple chromosome looks like. Pretty fancy. But before this cell undergoes mitosis, it's got to be replicated. Right, and then it gets replicated, it looks something like this. So we call that a chromosome, but it has what? It actually has two pieces that are identical to each other. Here is the first one, then here is the second one right here. But they're joined together, we just call that a chromosome. So that during mitosis, these two different things can separate, and each cell gets one here, okay, and one in here. So mitosis, asexual reproduction, and just for fun, what are the two functions for mitosis? Asexual reproduction. Growth? Right? Growth is one. What's another reason? Replace old and damaged cells. Maybe you want to think of some of the things we talked about in lab. Because at one point in time, you were just a single cell. Anybody remember what that single cell you was called? A zygote. And, you know, that's a pretty fancy cell, I would agree, since it's a human cell, but not all that much fun, because why? If you're a zygote, you can't come to lecture. You can't browse the internet, right? All that kind of stuff. All right, so how do you get from the stage of being a zygote to you that can surf the internet? Mitosis, right? So you can add billions of cells to your body. And then don't forget, okay, a lot of cells in your body die all the time, like blood cells. How many red blood cells die in your body all the time, every second? About 2 million, right? And so you need to replace those that die. Otherwise, you become anemic, right? So mitosis is producing those 2 million cells every second in your body so that you don't become anemic. So that's the importance of mitosis, parent cell. All right, so the first part of the cell cycle replicates these chromosomes from being just a single chromosome to being replicated two chromosomes together ready for mitosis. It's not an official part of mitosis, it's just a phase of the cell cycle, which is probably the most important because it takes the longest. All right, so I want you to know all the phases of the cell cycle. And a way to know that is to know this acronym, IPMAT, and the letter of this acronym right here, like here's a T, that corresponds to the first letter of what? The first word or the last word of the sequence of mitosis? It's the last phase, right? All right, so what are these phases? I, right, for interphase. And what happens during interphase? It takes the longest because a lot of things have to replicate themselves. Like all the DNA has to replicate itself because it's going to split. You don't want one cell to have all the mitochondria and none in this one here. You don't want this cell to end up with all the chromosomes and none down over here. You want these cells to be what? Identical to each other. So interphase sort of looks like this, and it's a growth phase. When the cell's ready to split, what's the first phase? Prophase. I want you to know a few key points about prophase, and then the next one is metaphase. What does meta mean? Middle. Okay. Anaphase. You know, if you're curious about some of these things, like meta, where could you look that up? Metaphase and then telophase. Like if you wanted to know what telo means, where could you look that up really fast? Some of you could do it right now because you have phones that can do it. Yeah, just Google it really fast. And probably one of the key things in Wikipedia or something will tell you what the root of that word is. Okay, that doesn't take very long. All right, so interphase is a growth phase that has all the organelles, including the nucleus. So what's protecting the chromosomes from all of the processes that are happening in the cytoplasm right here? Well, it's a nuclear envelope. That's why it's there, because the chemistry of the cytoplasm could destroy some of these chromosomes. So what happened to the cell? Those chromosomes get damaged. Cell dies. Can't reload software if you're a cell. You either have it or you don't. If you have it, you can stay alive. Okay. Then, what is next? Let's look at these pictures. Okay. So here you have just DNA that's being used. That means that translation is happening, okay, and transcription inside the nucleus, so information is being converted from DNA to RNA. In order for that to happen, the DNA has to be in really long filaments. And don't forget, these are hugely long filaments, and they're very fragile. They can break, okay, they can be acted on by other kinds of compounds in the cytoplasm. So what's a good idea, what's a good little model in your mind to understand how long all of these filaments of DNA are? Exactly how long are they? For instance, if we took all the DNA in your body and strung it from end to end just as a single filament, it would be what? Reach from here to the moon, about 250,000 miles. Right? So that's a huge distance. All right? But we want to get this nuclear membrane out of the way so that we can undergo mitosis. So those long filamentous molecules have to be packaged in a certain way to protect them. So it's wrapped up on proteins. And we can see how a long strand of DNA gets wrapped up on these histone proteins, and then the histones come together to form this supercoil, and then the supercoils will even coil on themselves to make even hyper supercoils. So when you coil all these long filaments up, what happens to the length? Yeah, it shortens up, right? It becomes a nice package, and then the chromosome can't break, the information is protected. But if it's coiled up like this, of course, then it can't be used. That's just a trade-off. All right, but if it's packaged up, then the DNA goes from an extended form that looks like this, which can be used for transcription, to a condensed form. And the condensed form is a safe package of DNA, can't be damaged. All right, so in mitosis, chromatin goes from what? Extended to condensed. And when it's condensed, then the nuclear envelope can disappear. So here you see chromatin condensing into chromosomes. It's being packaged with all those protein molecules. Now it's in a very safe form, so the nuclear envelope can disappear. That's one of the important bullet points with prophase. Well, there's 2 points. Extended chromatin condenses into chromosomes that you can actually see under the microscope, and what? The nuclear membrane disappears. The other thing that happens are these centrioles that arrange microtubules, okay, appears to form this spindle apparatus. So that's the third point for prophase. And on the practicum, I'm just going to want to know prophase. I don't have to know early prophase or late prophase. And these are the slides that I'm going to show you so that you can, right, so you can study these things at home. You don't need a microscope at home. Though you probably looked at a lot of different cells, some plant cells, the onion root, and the worm cells undergoing mitosis. So these are both prophase. And when you look at these chromosomes right here, what is the arrangement of these chromosomes in that spot where the nucleus used to be? What's the arrangement of these chromosomes? It's a difficult question. Because you see a pattern. There's no pattern. There's still just a random arrangement of chromosomes all over where the nucleus was. So I see a chromosome up over here. There's one here. Here I see a couple over here. And then some over, there's even one here behind the centriole, right here, this behind the spindle apparatus. So that's pretty much the characteristic of prophase. The chromosomes have not been arranged in any particular order. They still have just a random arrangement. All right, and what kind of chromatin is this right here? Is this extended or condensed chromatin? This is condensed, it's packaged into a chromosome. What kind of chromatin is this over here? It's extended. Remember, this is the useful kind, but it can be damaged. This is the protected kind of chromatin, but it can't be used for anything, right? It can only be moved around inside the cell. You don't have to worry about breaking it. All right, what's the phase after prophase? Metaphase. Remember, the microtubules right here, when they're controlled by these centrioles, act as a monorail system. So that monorail system can do what? Move the chromosomes around inside the cell. And so the next phase is after all the chromosomes have been pushed and pulled and they line up right on the equator of the cell. We call that the metaphase plate because they've hopped a ride on these microtubules. This is what we call metaphase. Here's where it looks like. You see the nice line right through here? That's metaphase. All right? That's the characteristic of metaphase. What about a characteristic of prophase? What happens? These two parts of this chromosome now start to separate. All right? So we could call these things daughter chromatids. All right? And when they start to separate, they become independent chromosomes on their own. So we call those daughter chromosomes when they start to separate. And what part of mitosis do they start to separate, be pulled apart? Anaphase. And I know this is anaphase right here because I see a nice bright line through here, a nice bright line through here, and then what, a dropout of a signal in between. I see like a stripe here, and a stripe here, and a stripe here. What about prophase? Do we see any arrangement at all? No stripes anywhere. I see chromosomes, but they're just kind of splattered all over the place. All right, so that's prophase. Right, and then anaphase, I see this kind of appearance. And then the very last phase, the nuclear envelope reappears. The chromosomes start to be unwound from those histone molecules and it starts to be used for transcription. So the chromosomes become extended, the chromatin becomes extended. The nuclear envelope reforms. And just as important then, these two cells, or this one cell, starts to pinch apart into two separate cells. Into the two daughter cells via this contractile ring causing this cleavage furrow between these two cells that are developing. And there's something that's pushing and pulling the cell membrane. Okay, what's pushing and pulling things inside the cell membrane to cause these cells to pinch apart? These microtubules again, because that's their job for moving things around inside the cell. It can actually move the membrane around. It can attach to the membrane and move it around. Okay, and so those are the three characteristics of telekinesis. The development of the cleavage furrow, the development of the plasma membrane once again, and chromatin going to an extended form from a condensed form. Now that process where this cleavage furrow develops and the cytoplasm is actually separated into two daughter cells right here, that has got a special name. It happens during telophase of mitosis, or telophase of the cell cycle, but it also has a special name because there's a lot going on producing this cleavage furrow right here. And guess what we call that? The process is cytokinesis, right? And for this class, in what phase of the cell cycle does cytokinesis take place? In this class, you're going to say telophase. In other classes, you might have to study it in a little bit more detail. And not every cell under all conditions and all species does cytokinesis only happen during telophase. But in this class, you're just going to say automatically telophase. Okay? All right, so cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells, but the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells, you want to call that what? Mitosis. So mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells, but the separation of all that other cellular junk into two daughter cells is called cytokinesis, and it doesn't happen during all the phases of mitosis. What phase of mitosis does it happen in? The telophase. Guess what telo means? Last, or tip, or end, right? So look some of those up and it will make more sense to you. So these diagrams could be on the practicum. Okay? All right, so I think we're doing pretty good. I got to go back talk about some membranes a little bit, but mostly I think we're done. All right, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Make sure you can recognize all those organelles by themselves. If I show you a mitochondria by itself, you can see it. Okay. All right, just a couple more figures that I want to show you. Okay, you're familiar with these cavities right here, right? Because last time in lab, you even had to draw the companion figure to this all, but you had to draw this one, right? Okay. But here's another one. Membranes. There are two general classes of membranes in your body. So let me draw these out for you. Membrane, two kinds, two major kinds. There's one that's called a mucous membrane, M-U-C-O-U-S, mucus, and I'll abbreviate membrane, M period, mucous membrane. Mucus is an adjective. What's an adjective? It's something that modifies the meaning of a noun. Like you could have water, but that might not tell you a lot because maybe it came out of the hot water heater. So what can you tell me about that water? It is hot water. So hot is an adjective. It modifies water that imparts some meaning. So mucus right here modifies membrane, meaning that it has a substance on it. That substance is, okay, in a lot of cases, mucus. All right? Did I spell that right? M-U-C-U-S? Yeah, I did. Okay. Mucus is a noun. It's the substance. Right, and if a membrane is secreting this substance, right, then it becomes a mucous membrane. Notice the spelling is a little bit different. O-U-S always means it's an adjective. If it's just U-S, it means it's a noun, okay, for mucous membrane. Okay, but a definition of a mucous membrane is that it lines a cavity or covers a surface that is open to outside world. Okay, can anybody give me an example of a mucous membrane, a membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world? Yeah, your mouth, nasal cavity, urinary tract, even your digestive tract because it's continuous with your mouth, right? That's a mucous membrane. The second kind of membrane right here is called a serous, O-U-S, membrane, and it is what? Not open to the outside world. So we looked at some cavities last time that are not open to the outside world. And guess what kind of membrane line those cavities? It's a serous membrane. Like, give me an example. The pericardial cavity. You don't want that open to the outside world. The pleural cavity on the outside of the lungs. Don't want that open to the outside world. The inside you do, but not the outside. The pelvic cavity. An abdominal cavity. You don't want that open to the outside world. Those are serous membranes. And serous membranes have three important divisions to them. So I'll write those down. One, two, three. Kind of from superficial to deep, you have a parietal division. The last part is the visceral division. And then you have the serous space between them. All right, so you got these three parts to a serous membrane. So we're talking about membranes that line these cavities right here. Let's give you a good model of how to think of these things. All right, so think of a balloon. And how many different surfaces does a balloon have? When you take a balloon and just blow it up? You know what? I say one. It just has the outside. All right, and then you got air on the inside. That's a nice, easy way to think about a balloon before you blow it up. Blow it up, tie it off. You got the outer part of the balloon. You got air on the inside. Now, let's do something special with that balloon without popping the balloon. Let's take this marker and shove it through so that now it's on the inside of the balloon without popping the membrane, because remember, it's rubbery, it can stretch. Or take your hand and put your hand inside the balloon. You still have that one surface, right? But it's kind of is folded to make two. So here's the balloon, the outside layer, and then when you put your hand in here, it actually forms over the inside of your hand. So this is a different part of the balloon compared to the part that's touching the outside. So here's the outside world over here. But this part of the balloon is different because what is it touching? It's not touching the outside world. What is it touching? Your hand, right? So this part of the balloon membrane is different from this one. Structurally, it's different. So this one right here is what we're going to call the parietal part of a serous membrane. The one that's touching the internal organs inside that cavity is the visceral part of this serous membrane. And then here is that space between them, which is what we call the serous space, and it's filled with serous fluid. And I think I'm going to start with next time with this one, but I went the wrong way. Where's some good figures? Here's a pretty good figure. All right, here is the heart. Let's zoom way in. Here's the heart inside a serous membrane. Here is the parietal pericardium, right? And it's continuous with a part of the pericardium that is right on the surface of the heart. What do we call that part of the membrane that's right on the surface of a visceral organ? The visceral serous membrane or the visceral pericardium. So here's the visceral pericardium. Here's the parietal pericardium. They're continuous with each other, but there's a space between them, and we call that the pericardial space or pericardial cavity filled with fluid, which is kind of a slippery fluid because what's happening, what does a heart do all day long? It's pounding all day long. It's got to have a nice slippery fluid in there so that it can move around. Otherwise, it gets inflamed and irritated. You don't want that to happen to your heart. All right, so let's view this again before we go to tissues next time. So you probably want to look over in your textbook some things on tissues and answer the pre-lecture reading assignment for tissues so that when I say something, it sinks in right away. Okay? What about SI? What are you guys talking about right now? Okay. Really good. Okay. See you guys.